everyone, and welcome to Empowering Homeschool Conversations. My name is Peggy Ployer, and I am the host of this weekly broadcast put on by Sped Homeschool, as well as its founder and CEO. We at Sped Homeschool empower families to home educate children with learning challenges. And I encourage you to check out our website at spedhomeschool.com to learn more about our resources and the support that we offer families. And some of the best resources that we have on our website, and I know I say this almost every week, is our partners. And I have another one of the Sped Homeschool partners on the broadcast today, and his name is Timothy Winey. Thank you for joining us, Timothy.
My pleasure.
Yeah. So Timothy is with Spellcode, and I'm going to put up your website here so that our viewers can see that while I'm doing a quick introduction. And I also want you to know, if you're popping on, feel free to share this. If you're watching on YouTube, send somebody an email saying you need to listen to this broadcast live. Or if you're on Facebook, share it around to some groups and friends, because we're going to talk about let me see if I can say this correct. Phonological awareness, or not awareness, but phonological, yeah, both awareness and everyday activities that'll increase that. I didn't have my notes up in front of me. So we're going to talk about like pre-reading and helping your student with some of those skills. And I know I had no idea when I first started homeschooling, even what phonics was, let alone phonological awareness. So I'm hoping to learn a lot here today, as well as you. And if you have comments or questions, if you're watching with us live, make sure you put them in the feed so we can make them as part of our conversation. We'd love to do that. That's why we do this live. And so definitely join in on the fun and do that. So yeah, as we're getting started, Timothy, I would love for you just to talk a little bit about just how you got started and what you do and why you're so passionate about helping kids learn to read.
Well, not to start on a downer.
Well, sometimes our stories start with something we're very passionate about because we had a struggle. Yeah.
Mine was no different. Actually, I had anticipated a struggle because my son was a toddler living in Portugal, and I wanted to make sure that if I had to teach him English, if he would be equipped to do that. And so I had sort of started researching on my own, and I stumbled across a book by a lady who's quite controversial. A lot of people really didn't like her because she was very outspoken, but she made a lot of sense. And it was a book, Why Our Children Can't Read. Mm. Her name was Diane McGinnis. And later I would take her training, well, not her training, but a training developed by her son and daughter-in-law in London. Huh. And of all places, I thought this building looks familiar, and it was bothering me. And then the woman presenting the class said, just so you know, this is the former Iranian embassy where they had the hostage situation in London.
Oh, wow.
In the exact room. So anyway, I felt some bad feng shui there, and it was actually, I was right. Anyway, so I digress. But so I read this book, and she said some very, very shocking things about reading that made a lot of sense to me. And having a musical background, it made even more sense to me because I had also read a bit about music and its influence on IQ and academic achievement. Mm-hmm. There's an awful lot of research on the so-called Mozart effect and the kids who study music bring it better. It was kind of a mystery. And now I actually believe I know why music, at least partially, contributes to academic success and has to do with phonological or code or English sound discrimination, right? So the smallest constituents in English are what we call phonemes. So the word cat has three phonemes in it. Cat. Cat is not a sound. Cat is a word, or one syllable word, more specifically. It's made up of three sounds. So if you think of cat as three Legos, cat.
Cat. Oh, that's a great way to think about it. Yeah, very visual.
Phonemes are, as it turns out, the same, the part of the brain responsible for distinguishing pitch is actually the same part of the brain responsible for distinguishing between sounds of your native language. So if you study music, your ears are pre-trained to distinguish between the subtle differences, especially vowel sounds, in your native tongue. So I bought their book. It's called Reading Reflex. I read everything. This is before I took the class. I was just in the middle of the ocean in the Azores Islands. And I just bought this book and read it. And again, this is before my son even started school. He was three. But I thought, I'm going to get a head start on this. And I read the book. And they had a little test there, phonological discrimination test. So basically, you take a young child and you ask them to manipulate sounds. So you say things like, frog. You ask them to say the word frog without the er sound, and they should be able to say fog. Or you say what is that? They should be able to glue those together and say frog, even though the sounds, the phonemes are segmented, right?
Right.
With silence in between. So I gave this test to my son, who was three at the time, and he had a perfect score. Now, they only recommend you give this test to kids over five. So here he is 2 years ahead of his peers, perfect score, absolutely perfect phonemic discrimination. And I actually attribute that to being bilingual. So he was processing
all the sounds.
So he's actually more finely discriminating. Now, maybe there was some music benefit because I was teaching and playing music at the time, and maybe there's some struggle with that. Who knows? Maybe vicariously. He wasn't studying music, but I was teaching the violin in a music conservatory and playing in a chamber orchestra. So I also I drew the connection between the musical ear training and the phonological ear training, and I actually set up an ear training laboratory in the conservatory. So I put in a proposal for computers and the software, and we actually had a structured progressive ear training. Basic ear training is you play a note on the piano and then you play a note above it, and you're supposed to know that interval. What is that? Is that a major third, a minor third, a sixth, a seventh, whatever, an octave? It turns out that if you always play if the low note is always the same note and the upper note varies, that's easier than if they both float. We call that a floating tonic. So if you move the low note, that's harder. Well, there's an analog to that in reading.
Really?
And that is the use of tongue twisters. So it turns out that if you work with kids where the first letter, the consonant of each word, is the same, then when they form the different vowel sounds following the first consonant, their mouth is always in the same referent position. So Peter Piper picked sounds and is different for the child to produce than Cedar, Liker, Nicked, right? Because the shape of the mouth is not the same. So that's how tongue twisters became incorporated into my intervention. I realized that it's too hard for kids to distinguish these vowel sounds and worry about the consonant because the mouth has to come from a different position.
Right. So you're always going back to that square one.
Exactly. It was just a strange confluence and connection of music ideas, the science behind the brain and how it processes sounds. And trying to keep things simple and easy for the early reader. So that was sort of, in a nutshell, it gives you a sense of why I looked into phonetics in the first place, because I had this English-speaking toddler that I wanted to make sure to learn English, and my musical background. So it was just sort of a strange confluence of events. And then later that became incorporated into my teaching when I started teaching elementary school for the U.S. military.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I've never heard that before. But it makes so much sense when you say it. So thank you for diving into that and sharing just what you learned as you were starting to research that. So phonological awareness what actually is it? You know, how would it be defined? And then how does it affect reading and learning?
Yeah, well, phonological awareness is really just the recognition that words are made up of these discrete sounds. Now, that's easier said than, I mean, that's sort of, it's almost trite to say it. Of course, kids are phonologically aware, because if they weren't, they couldn't talk, right?
Yeah.
So, how was your day at school, John? You know, it was fun. I played with Billy. You know, if the kid can talk, they already know all the sounds of English. Mm. Knowing the sounds of English and reproducing them is turns out to be quite natural. Kids talk.
Yeah, they mimic. Yep.
They don't roll out of bed reading, however. And the reason for that is, as I said earlier, when a child learns the word cat, it goes by so fast, they just learn cat. They just, it's cat. Yeah. Cat is cat. Cat is, they don't know it's three sounds. They just know it's cat. Mm. In fact, if you ask first or second graders, typically, how many sounds are in the word cat, and if they haven't been consciously taught these methods, they'll say one.
Mm.
No, that's a syllable. How many sounds are in the word one? And you can just do that all day.
Uh-huh.
So what I did with my students, actually, is especially the ones that were, I knew were struggling, I gave informal, the test I gave my son, I gave them. I didn't say, we're going to test you now. How many sounds are in the word cat? I would just play games with them. And in 5 minutes in a class of 20 kids, I knew it was who. I mean, I didn't even need to set them aside. I could just do it in a group. But basically, if a child has problems distinguishing between the spellings, basically, of the sounds of a word that we represent as spelling, every sound in a word has that spelling, right?
Right.
So in the word cat, the k sound, it happens to be spelled with a C, and A, and so on. But, you know, unless you misspell like Kit Kat, right? We can misspell a word too. But each word has so many sounds in it, and each sound has to have a spelling. So what I did with my second graders was I would record them saying monosyllabic words, cat, frog, what have you. And then I would, using a special audio editing software, I would slow it down so they could hear their voice.
Oh, their own
without
voice.
Changing the pitch. Same pitch, but then I would insert a little bit of silence, maybe half a second of silence between the phonemes. So they would hear themselves say, cat, and it was their voice.
Right.
And that was quite a revelation for them. Wow, cat really does have three sounds in it. Mm. Now, wouldn't you like to know how that works? Wouldn't you like to be able to write that? Yeah. and from that, once they're aware that that written English is coded speech, literally what it is. It's what comes out of our mouth, put on paper, then they're off and running. But they have to first, the non-negotiable prerequisite of reading is that A, you recognize that words are made up of these smaller constituents, and that B, they have spellings associated with them. Mm. So that's in a nutshell, that's sort of like the definition of writing, right? When you write, let me give you my definition of reading and writing. So you don't confuse me with others. When I say writing, this is what I actually mean. I say that when you write a word, there's really only two things that go on. First, in your mind's ear, you imagine how many sounds that word has in it. So if I go to, I mean, this happens quickly, but if you slow down the mental process, this is really what's going on. So let's take the word frog, since that's sort of our word of the day. Frog. Good. So before I even think about spelling, I have to count the sounds. If I don't count the sounds, then I'm dead before I begin. I have to know that frog has four sounds in it. Then I decide how to spell good. It's so, as you can see, you can't take prenatal vitamins after the baby's born. It's nonsense, right? Similarly, you can't spell with my definition of spelling, which, by the way, is the only correct one, because spelling is a nonsense unless you know how many sounds there are, which you are deciding how to spell.
Right.
Now, let me prove that to you. I have an example here. Very low-tech example. If I wrote this down just moments ago, let's look at the word cough and the word though. I love this example. I don't know if this will show up. when you see this.
Yep, you've got to bring it just a little bit closer, and I think we saw it. So, yeah, there we go.
Okay, focus. So here we have two words. They both have O-U-G-H in them.
Hmm.
However, the word cough is a three-sound word, and the word though only has two sounds. So how is a child supposed to make sense of this?
Hmm,
they see these four letters together, and well, hang on a minute. So now we're back to reading. So put writing aside. So if a child reads, it's not the same process. Writing, I explained to you, you count the sounds, and mm-hmm. then you decide how to spell them. But you have to learn to read in order to write or to spell. So let's reverse the logic and say, okay, now we're reading. We look at a word in a book. If we don't decide how many sounds that word has in it, we can't partition that and decide which letters spell which sound.
Mm.
So now if you look at the word cough, let's revisit the word cough. You look at the word cough, right?
Yep.
And what do you do? Well, you have to decide it has three sounds, and then you have to decide how to spell those sounds. Well, if not, what happens? The child could read co.
Mm-hmm.
Co, and then they could read thoth. For though, in other words, if they fail to group O-U-G-H as one spelling
mm-hmm.
for one sound, they could just reverse these and read cough as co and though as thoth.
Yes.
So unless you teach the spelling patterns, which is we have a very systematic way of doing that, that eliminates confusion for the child, but I don't want to muddy the waters.
Mm.
Just for the audience and for you, my definition of reading is counting the sounds and learning and deciding which way to spell them.
Hmm.
And reading is looking at a word and deciding literally where are the spellings for these sounds.
Hmm.
Is O-U-G-H one sound or is O-U a sound and G-H another sound? These are the decisions you have to make mm-hmm. when you read and write. Now, the trick here is, as we say, the devil is in the details. So how do you make sure that when a child looks at though, they don't say thought?
Right.
Well, mm-hmm. that comes later. I can explain that a little bit later if time permitting.
Mm-hmm.
But suffice it to say, if the child doesn't clearly know the sounds of English and is not able to identify them, they can't even begin. They have to do that. Now, if you ask a child that had maybe ear infections in toddlerhood, that's a big problem.
Yes.
They're more accurately processing sounds. They can talk. So you think, oh, after all, this kid, he can talk. Wrong. They don't hear discrete phonemes the way kids who didn't have ear infections do. This is a problem that goes very
common. Right, and we hear a lot of families have kids who've had ear infections.
And guess what? The reason we know this is a problem is because if I ask a child who had ear problems to spell, let's say, cough, they might spell it KF. They're only hearing two sounds. You can't represent three sounds with two letters. So they're literally two consonants. Cough. Where's the ah? Right away, I start asking the parent questions about their health history because that tells me that they're not hearing ah. And they've chosen not even to represent it with any letter. So if a kid spells cough K-O-F and they're 6 years old, that doesn't bother me. At least I know they hear three sounds.
Right.
At least they've assigned a spelling to each sound. And then from there, I can easily teach them all of the possible spellings for those sounds and make a more educated guess about which was the best way to spell each sound. But we can't even start the race unless we know the child can identify and reproduce the 40 or so phonemes of English that we represent with a 26-letter alphabet, which is why English is so complicated.
Right.
But that's, in a nutshell, that's it. And so the last thought I wanted to get here is fleeting now, my aging brain here. The test that we give the kids. See, when I was, I'm not a big computer learning buff. I think in the future, you know, rich kids will have teachers and poor kids will be strapped to computers. Mm. But there's one good thing about computers that I couldn't get away from, that it's absolutely essential for this. And that is the automation of it, exposing kids to this consistently to the correct sounds.
Oh, yes. Very easily to repeat.
And repeat it. So every kid in my general classroom who had problems reading would go back to the computer and they would just sit and watch basically a randomized slideshow where they would see aw, dog, ah, cat. And they would learn the sounds of English, starting with the vowels, which are the most difficult, and the rest of those sounds. Now, what are the most commonly misspelled words in English? It turns out it's almost always a soft vowel. So the soft vowels that we make are the most similar in the mouth, and they're the most difficult to distinguish with the ears. So all kids that have trouble reading and spelling have trouble with These are the soft vowels. So if you're a ventriloquist, they're the easiest because you hardly have to move your mouth, but E, U, I, O, these are all very different. So is it photosynthesis? Is it photosynthesis? Is it photosynthesis? Is it photosynthesis? These are the soft vowels that confuse people, that are the if you type in most commonly misspelled English words, it's always a multisyllabic word with a soft vowel. So I train the kids right off the bat to accurately identify the soft vowels. So when they go to spell "ah," I know that they know clearly in their mind that that's what they're trying to spell. Sometimes they spell "eh," and it's correct because they hear in their mind's ear "eh." So they're spelling correctly, but they're misimagining the sound.
Right.
So you have to make sure they can hear them and identify them and reproduce them accurately before you can even start. So in a nutshell, if you were in my classroom, you were a kid, they would sit at the computer, work on it, and they'd come up to me all confident, and I would show them a picture of the letter A, and that would be our universal symbol for A. And I would say, "What sound is that?" And they'd say, "Oh, nope, sorry." And then march back to the computer. And it took 2 hours. Two hours for most kids to learn all the sounds of English with 100% reliability, something no amount of bad teaching can unteach you once they learn the sounds. It's like learning the names of 40 people. They just know their names. Once they can do that, they're off and running.
Wow. Just those 40 things. Yeah, that's amazing. And it takes the complexity out of, I know when I first, you know, was teaching my kids to read, it was so mind boggling to me as to how I was going to make this happen. And this just sounds so simple.
It is, but you know what? I'll tell you something. I don't like to tell people this because it sounds, it sounds kind of pessimistic, I guess is the word, but I don't understand how anybody reads. I'll be honest with you, because if you look at the 40 sounds of English, well, give or take, and then you look at all the possible spelling variations, it seems impossible. How does a young child sort through all these possible combinations so quickly? It just seems like a statistical impossibility because they're sorting through all these combinations. It's kind of a miracle. I mean, it is. I mean, the real question we should be asking is, how does anybody learn to read? Not why are these kids struggling? How does anybody learn to read? Because it's a statistical nightmare when you think about all the spelling combinations and the sounds of English. And the problem I showed you with cough and though, how do you sort that out, right? Well, as it turns out, it's not as difficult as you might imagine. It's more to do with what you teach in what order and whether or not it's systematically and logical for the child. Because we can rationalize anything. We can say this is logical, but the proof is in the pudding. Can the kids learn to read?
Right.
Now, here's the definition, not my definition, but here's the definition by all the smartest people in reading science. And no two people will disagree on this. This is agreed on by everybody. The most reliable predictor of reading fluency and by extension, comprehension. In other words, the strongest predictor of how well someone reads by the common definition, can you read a book and understand it and tell me what was in the book,
right,
is the person's ability to read pseudo words. That is, silly words that are in the dictionary,
right,
or that are not in the dictionary, rather, but conform to English spelling conventions. So that's the gold standard. And it's there's a test called Dibbles. There's others, but Dibbles is probably the most well-known. And that's what we use to predict reading success. Now, if you can read these list of silly words or pseudo words, floke, you know, weird words that a computer could read to you, but that are not in the dictionary, then right, you can read, because you're applying the spelling code to these correct spellings of words that don't exist.
Right.
The reason that we don't ask kids to read words like bike and Susie is because they've seen those a million times.
Right. They've memorized them.
They're Chinese pictograph. It doesn't prove anything. So this is what I did to prove that I knew what I was doing. Because who am I? I'm just some second grade teacher. Who is this guy? So I decided, okay, I'm going to videotape my little second graders trying to read these pseudo words. And I took the low readers. They were really non-readers. I mean, they could write their name, but they couldn't even, I mean, that was just a picture. They didn't even know how to read their own name. So I gave them this list and I said, read these words to me. And of course they couldn't. And I videotaped that. I then ran them through my program. A couple of months later, I retested them, videotape, and of course they could read the list fine. Now, you talk about upsetting people. So I take these findings to Oxford University. I meet with the top people in the psychology department that study this problem. I play them the video of these little 7 and 8 year olds not reading and then reading. I tell them the time interval between the first and second test. And they said, this meeting is adjourned. We do not believe this is possible. They just went red. They were furious. They thought I had to have cheated, because nobody should go from non-reader to reader in a general classroom this quickly. It's just not possible. They just said, I'm sorry, we need, this is, you're wasting our time. I'm not kidding. They were actually annoyed with me. They didn't even want an explanation. So, I took these very same kids and I gave them a reading inventory. It's called a developmental reading assessment, or DRE, I think. And it's just a little computer test. So they go to a computer lab, they read little short paragraphs and they answer questions about them. You can't really do this test unless you somehow log in on the kids' behalf and do the answers for them. So the kids are in the, I'm not even administering the test. This is on a computer with another teacher running the lab. So they go through this test. We had a baseline test. Many of the kids got no correct answers or few correct. They were non-readers. And then after a period of time, it wasn't a big period. It was like 3 months, I think. They were retested. And it's randomized. It's not even the same story. And there were huge jumps. Some kids went from non-reader to third grade, and these were second graders. Okay? So I presented those findings, those scores, to Scholastic, who produced this test. And they said, well, we have no reason to doubt you, because we don't think it's technically possible for you to have cheated on this exam unless you, I don't know, had them. You couldn't even have them practice the exam in the lab because the story changed. They said, even though we know you didn't cheat, we could not accept this statistically. These scores are so, the differentials are so great that we could not include them in a normal statistical distribution. They would just be discarded as outliers. Now, I mean, these are the publishers of the test.
Crazy. Yeah. So, but you're upsetting a norm, and people don't like that when they have in their minds, this is the amount of time it should take for a student to read. This is the process they should go through, and it shouldn't be this simple.
Well, do you remember No Child Left Behind, all this fanfare, No Child Left Behind? Well, there was a reading portion of that called Reading First. Uh-huh. And that legislation was written by a gentleman named Bob Sweet. He's deceased now. But Bob Sweet, Robert J. Sweet, was the founder of the National Right to Read Foundation. And they got him and they said, we want you to tell us what scientific-based reading is. And we want to put it in legislation. We want to discourage schools from teaching reading inefficiently and ineffective. Okay. So he wrote the legislation, and it's, I mean, I think it's maybe the law expired, but it, he was the brains behind Reading First. And that was a $6 billion program with a B. That was a big program. He wrote it. I sent Bob my scores, and he was just flabbergasted. And he believed me because he knew all the top science people in reading. He'd read everything there ever was to read about. And it actually made sense to him. He didn't dismiss it outright because he could see the difference between what I was doing and what traditional phonics was doing. Traditional phonics works, and it has worked for, you know, more than 100 years. But in a general classroom with other things going on, the labor intensity of that was not, it wasn't practical. I mean, I could pull any kid aside and teach them the old-fashioned way. But it turns out it's unnecessarily time-consuming and laborsome, both for the adult and the child. And so... I just started, I did it my way, as Frank Sinatra used to sing. I taught the sounds. I taught them the possible spellings for each sound in a systematic way. But I started with very precise ear training and worked from there. I didn't assume they knew all the sounds just because they could talk.
Right.
And I that's sort of, that was the jumping off point.
So, you know, we have a lot of families that that have kids with auditory processing issues. And I know you talked a little bit about music. Is music and some other techniques helpful in helping a child who has that auditory processing issue?
Without a doubt. I mean, if they're especially if they're playing an instrument that requires them to tune it. In other words, the piano, you put the button in.
Right.
But if you're singing or playing the violin or anything that requires you to tune it, it can do nothing but good for you. I would imagine that singing helps a lot too, because obviously you have to produce the sounds,
right?
And you have to do it in time. That is to say, you can't take forever to produce the sound. It has to be on a beat. So all these things speed up cognition, but they also wire the brain for learning sounds. And I would predict that anybody that learns a musical instrument is not only more likely to be a better reader, but they're probably more likely to acquire a second or third language more easily also. So I'm told that I have a good accent. Like in Portugal, it gets me in trouble because even though I speak Portuguese, my vocabulary isn't quite what it should be. I mean, I lived here, you know, I lived in Portugal over 20 years ago. I spent the last 20 years in the United Kingdom in England.
Okay.
And then I moved back to Portugal. And so I'll start talking to someone and they'll think I'm native or near native because I sound Portuguese. And then they'll just start talking very fast and hang on. Right. So, but I do sound, there's certain words that I'm told that only I can, that I can pronounce like a native, and the typical American or Canadian can't. So I attribute that to the musical training, really.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So what are some other things that families can do to really help with that phonological awareness with students that really struggle in that area?
Well, I think some of it's natural. Like we talk about baby talking or mother slowing down and even mouthing the words. You know, these masks aren't helping. I'm here to tell you, there's some studies that have come out recently that are very discouraging about childhood development, because you have certain windows of development that just can't be, you can't unscramble the egg, you can't go back and redo that. So you have, you know, young kids in kindergarten, first, second grade, they're looking at their teacher, the teacher is talking. If they're not seeing that, they're not connecting, they're not lip reading, they're not connecting the shape of the mouth with the sounds that come out. You're modeling how you make sounds. When I taught, I exaggerated my speech. You know, I would say things like, I'm going to do many things today. I'm going to take roll. I am going to find out who wants hot lunch. Et cetera, you know, and I would exaggerate these pronunciations so they would know. And I just did that instinctively. And I think mothers do that with sort of with baby talk. With kids, you can play games with them. You could say, you know, frog. How many sounds are in the word frog? You can literally make it a game. I played games with my son. I said, say the word frog backwards. What do you mean backwards? Backwards. Garf. Literally, he could do that when he was 3 years old. So he was already practicing, and he didn't know it. I mean, he didn't know it was a lesson.
It's kind of like a little challenge, and kids love that.
Say this word, but take out the last sound. Frog. Mm. Right? Say frog without the first sound. Frog. I mean, you could spend an hour on frog. Mm-hmm. It's just a question of identifying sounds, isolating them. We call that segmenting, where you spread it out and say each sound, blending, putting them together, deleting. Mm-hmm. You can even ask them to do substitutions, right? Say the word frog with a t at the beginning. I'm sorry. Say the word frog and replace the first sound with t. Trog. I mean, and it's just, it's really just a question of them, making them aware the words are built up of little Legos we call phonemes.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be moved around, they can be rearranged. But those are the smallest constituents of speech. And, you know, the Phoenicians who invented writing, we say phonetic because it's the Phoenicians. Somebody really smart a long time ago said, hey, we have these sounds coming out of our mouths and, you know, we have this massive shipping empire. How are we going to keep track of all these goods and grain and all this? I mean, the beginning of accounting and literally the beginning of civilization, I would argue, was the moment that some spark went off in some Phoenician's head and said, hey, make these sounds, let's write them down. And we all speak the same, so we should all be able to decode this stuff and keep track of everything. I mean, that's probably the invention, in quotes, that defines the human race, right? Or civilization. The idea that we make sounds, we can encode that into writing, and then we can keep track of things. Chinese are different. Chinese is, these are pictures of things that some of them are symbolic, some do represent sounds. But I always tell people, Chinese is a pictographic language. Let's pick Mandarin. Mandarin, everyone in China can read the same newspaper because everyone in China interprets the same symbols the same way. So in China, whatever this is, let's say, is house. So everybody that looks at the paper knows that means house. However, they all speak differently. When Mr. So-and-so from this part of China says house, and Mr. So-and-so from that part of China says house, they don't say the same sound, so they can't talk to each other. They all read the same newspaper.
Wow.
So that's not, you know, it's apples and oranges. It's not English. It's a phonographic or graphophonemic language. It is coded speech. And the sooner kids learn the sounds of their native tongue, the sooner you can start teaching them how to spell those sounds and how to recognize spellings when they read. So they're kind of reverse processes of each other.
Right.
It all starts with that. It all starts with phonemic discrimination, then manipulation. Remember, there's no point manipulating the Legos if you don't know, A, how many Legos you have, and B, what order you can put them in. So you have to count the Legos. We have three here. How can you arrange them? So, these are all prerequisites. Identify the sound. Then manipulate the sound. Then recognize the sound as a spelling and so on. So this hierarchical. You can't just dive in and say, spell this. Well, I don't know how many sounds are in the word. Oh, I didn't teach you the sounds. I'm sorry. Right?
Right.
So you start to see how it's just like, run. I'm 2 weeks old. I don't even know how to crawl, right? These are just developmental stages that are part of an unnatural process. You know, English writing was an invention. Writing is not something you come out of the womb doing, and it's something you don't naturally acquire by accident just by, you know, running through the jungle. Somebody has to teach you how to write and read. And this is an unnatural process. Reading is the slowing down of speech. And writing is the encoding of that slowing down. You have to hear the sounds to write them, and you have to identify them to read them. And it's a
right.
it's a process of stretching it out so you can really hear it. Natural mm-hmm. speech, people talk, they don't know, they don't hear. You couldn't learn to talk if I said at
right.
book box. You know, kitty litter, you know, mm-hmm. you could never give instructions that slowly. Kids wouldn't process the information. Speech has to sound natural.
Mm.
So that's why you just talk to kids like you've always talked to kids, but you don't teach kids to read in the same way they learn to acquire speech. It's just not the same thing at all.
Right. Yeah. So you had talked previously a little bit about tongue twisters. Is there something yes. that parents can do in using tongue twisters to help with their children that struggle in this area?
Yes, because again, when you, let me put it to you this way. If you didn't have access to my method and you just wanted to work with your kid,
mm-hmm.
you could never do any harm by working with them using tongue twisters. And that's mm-hmm. why they're part of traditional lore, you know, tongue twisters.
Yeah, I think we've lost that though.
Yes.
And definitely.
Not just for entertainment. Tongue twisters provide a valuable sort of hidden benefit of if the ear training is built into it. So when you say, as I said earlier, the mouth has a common reference. So every word starts with that. Peter, Piper. Already the kid is hearing E and I following, so it's always the same interval, like mm-hmm. like with the musical analogy with ear training. So P, Pi, P.
Mm-hmm.
You can even do abbreviated tongue twisters where you say P, Pi, P, Pa.
Oh,
pa.
Yeah, Peter, just Piper, first sound. Mm-hmm.
And yeah. so they hear them. And mm-hmm. then once they hear them, then, oh, that's just, I know it's hard to believe, but that's so much easier than Peter, Cyper, Ficked, a sack. It's much harder. So Pee, Pie, Pit, Pack. Peter Piper picked a pack. Pee, Pie, Pit. And then again, if you're not wearing a mask, the child will see Pee, Pie, E-I, E-I. They'll see it. They'll see
right.
the transition.
Your mouth is in a different shape, so they can imitate it.
Yeah. And it sounds silly, and it sounds, you know, it sounds contrived, but it's not. They need that because, again, reading and writing are not natural. They're a technology.
Hmm.
The only way to unlock that technology is to slow it down and make it transparent, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, before x-rays were invented, you know, people like Leonardo had to cut people open to see what was inside. They didn't know.
Right.
Right. Well, we need to do an autopsy on English. We need to cut it open and see what these things are made of. It's really like a magnification. Mm. And these little drills help with that. They help tune the ear. They help train the eye to see. Because when children see the mouth, pee, pie, they copy that. That's how they learn to talk from baby talk with mom.
Mm.
And that's when mommy goes down.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Baby talk. Uh-huh. Mommy doesn't go to the office and talk to her boss the way she talks to her baby, right? So we already know that the baby can't handle that. I'm going to need this by Monday morning on my desk. We don't do that.
Right.
Right?
We hope we don't.
Hopefully you're doing that instinctively, right? You don't have such poor maternal instincts that you're talking to your kid like you would, an auction. But, yeah, that's a good example of how some of that's already built in.
And I know you shared with me in our planning of this conversation something about being able to mix music with tongue twisters too. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I mean, you could sing. See, here's the thing about tongue twisters. I have to back up a little bit. It's really hard to talk. It's hard to talk about the sounds without talking about the relationship to the spelling code because one, it's sort of how do I put this? If you don't, obviously the goal here is to learn to read and write. I mean, ultimately we want to learn to read and write. So you can spend the rest of eternity playing with sounds. This goes by very quickly, by the way. I don't want to give folks the impression that they spend forever on sound. Remember, it's a couple hours. Mm-hmm. all a second grader really needs is to be strapped to a chair facing a computer and to see the and then come back and be checked by me. Now, unless I'm mishearing the sounds, which I can assure you I'm not, that child is guaranteed to pass that level of that prerequisite that is necessary for reading. So I don't want to give the idea to folks that unless you did tongue twisters with your toddler up until the point they start school, then they're doomed. That's not true. Mm-hmm. I've never had a student that I could not teach all the sounds of English in a few hours. Some took a little longer than others because some had ear infections and other problems. But no kid ever escaped my grasp. no kid ever got out of second grade.
Well, that's great hope for our parents, too. Especially.
On that. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're all learning to distinguish those subtle but very distinct vowel sounds, most importantly. The vowel sounds are the hardest. And I mean, I had a kid, he was a British kid, and he had a very thick British accent. And he actually said the word tandy for candy. That's how he said candy. Mr. Whitey, could I have some tandy? He said tandy. And he wrote candy on a spelling test. And I marked it as correct. Because he was literally writing what he says.
Right. Yeah. Well,
But I'm backing up. The reason I say I have to back up is because on the spelling code issue, So imagine the kids learn their sounds. Okay, so you got your typical 6, 7, 8-year-old. They've learned their sounds. Now what?
Right.
Well, you show them, and this is on the website. Folks really have to see my video because I do go systematically through. It's about a half an hour, but it's the best half hour you'll ever spend because I show the progression of what is taught when and why. Now, I don't want to do that here. That's not really the purpose of this. But suffice it to say that once they learn the sounds, then they can immediately dive into manipulating those sounds because they learn one and only one symbol for each sound. That's the magic of this method. Every time they see the letter A, it's A. It can't be anything else but A. Every time they see the letter S, it's S. Every time they see the letter K, it's K. So for them, that's just a picture of that sound. It also happens to be a spelling, but we use that as a universal phonetic alphabet, basically.
Got it.
So when the Pope gives a speech, in whatever, in Chinese, the popes typically speak more than one language. They tend to be well-educated, and, you hear about Pope this and Pope that. They spoke 5 languages and 6 languages. I can assure you there's no Pope that ever spoke 140 languages. But they have all these speeches and all these obscure languages. Well, how is this possible? Well, they have a phonetic alphabet. It's just like Morse code. They know, they have it superimposed, and they just read the sounds. So anybody can learn to master, a couple dozen sounds and know what, you see this picture and you make this sound. So what I do with the kids at the beginning stages is they literally build words. And they can be real words, or they can be nonsense words. It doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter.
Right.
What matters is, can you glue these together and make words? Can you also see them and read it or write it? It works in both directions. And that's why they got a perfect or near perfect score on the pseudo reading test after just a couple of months. And that's why they nearly called security on me at Oxford University, because I couldn't believe it. It literally could be that young kids could master the machinery that it takes to read pseudo words, which, by the way, again, without exception, is the gold standard among reading researchers. If you ask anybody that studies reading, you'll say, what is the strongest predictor of reading success? And they will always tell you it's pseudo word mastery. Can they read silly words? Just like, what's the biggest predictor of diabetes? Obesity. And there's other things that contribute to it, But if you're really big, you're way more likely to get diabetes than not. So it's such an obvious connection that it really is kind of the definition of reading. So if you were to ask me, what's reading? I would say the ability to read pseudo words. How can we teach a kid to read pseudo words? I'm glad you asked. You know, I did it for 8 years, and I told everybody that would listen. The parents loved it because, you know, they were off the hook. Third grade teacher loved it because all of my students went to them ready to hit the road ground running.
Right. By the way, yes.
Here's the sad statistic. If you're not reading at grade level by the end of third grade, you have a 1 in 5 chance of reading at grade level at the end of 9th grade.
Well, because it's not taught in the schools. Once they get through that certain grade level, there you can go to reading intervention, but really they're trying to push those kids through that curriculum.
It's like the prenatal vitamins after the kid's born. If you're not reading at third grade, see, this is what happens, and this is so sad. Parents think their kid can read because they think they can read, and they go to the first grade and the second grade. Then they hit third grade, and then they hit fourth grade, and suddenly they're not just reading cute stories. They're reading instructions, like how to do an experiment, or they're reading history, and they have to talk about why, so they have to interpret. And suddenly, oh, wait a minute, we lied. They can't read because they can't do what reading is supposed to do for you.
Right. They were just kind of skimming by before.
And then the parents are furious. How could this be? How could my kid have been untaught? The answer was they never learned to read. Right. They just sort of gave you the illusion of that. And that's really the sad commentary on much of public education is we can sort of do kind of almost a magic act and give the parents a sense that the child can read. But I would always say to them, give them a list of pseudo words. They can read flib and flues and clove. If they can't, then something's really wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the beauty of homeschooling is we can still work on that. We don't have any set time when our child has to master. I mean,
I can teach an adult to read just as quickly as a child. It's nothing special about kids. I'm referencing kids because that was my
right experience. And that makes total sense, though, in a structured learning environment that they're just moved on every year. And
An adult, illiterate, you know, an adult who for whatever reason didn't learn to read, whether it was ear problems or just bad teaching, whatever, you show me an adult who can't read and I can teach them to read 6 contact hours. Because they have the vocabulary too, you know. They learn the sounds. They use the spelling code chart, and they can read independently in just a few contact hours. I mean, imagine the human misery. You know, I am. It's not just me that says this. People smarter than I have said this. That illiteracy costs America more in terms of human misery and money than the wars on poverty, drugs, crime, and terrorism combined. There is no bigger problem and no bigger drag on the U.S. economy and social cohesion than poor literacy. It's the elephant in the living room. It ruins everything. It predicts how many jails you're going to need. They actually look at regional reading scores to predict jail space, new construction.
Wow.
It predicts everything from your likelihood of dying young to divorcing to have, you know, taking an overdose because you misread your prescription. There's no problem in modern life that isn't made infinitely worse and more complicated by poor reading.
Yeah. That's so good to remember. Kathy said, this is fascinating. I'll be sharing with parents. And she did ask before your website, but I did put it up. But I would love for you to close out our time talking a little bit about spellcode.info, if you're listening to the podcast, that's Timothy's website. But what can parents find there as far as resources and then the services that you offer?
Well, you know, as I say, I keep going back to the introductory video. It provides, you know, it's 30 minutes. You'll never get back, but you'll never regret it because it explains logically the progression from learning the sounds all the way up through and the rationale for it. And then you see, oh, you're kidding. How could this be this simple? You mean I just have to, the kid just has to learn these sounds and then learn this spelling process by virtue of that. Yeah, it's so mm-hmm. stupid.
Yeah, I remember when we first met and I thought, this is amazing.
I have to say two things. The road to hell is not just paved with good intentions, but it's paved with good intentions fueled by untested assumptions, right? Mm, and there are two untested good. Assumptions that were made in psychology, I'll call it, that kind of single-handedly handicapped America. One was World War I. They decided that we need to quickly divide officers from the enlisted men, and how are we going to do that? Well, some genius said, well, let's just go on reading fluency. So they lived for 100 years. The definition of an intelligent person was someone who read fluently. I kid you not. So 100 years of psychology wasted on this assumption. It turns out that intelligence and reading fluency are not correlated at all. Eye color is probably more relevant. They have no relationship to each other. So you could be a genius and a terrible reader, or quite a fluent reader and be an idiot. There's no relationship to them. So that just set us back 100 years. Now, fast forward, we do traditional phonics does sort of admit that we have to learn the sounds, we have to learn the spellings for those sounds. Fair enough. Mm-hmm. The grave untested assumption they made in traditional phonics was to assume that kids can't handle the full spectrum of the spelling code. That is to say, they can only handle certain spellings initially for the sounds. So they simplify it. So you end up with what we call controlled text. So you read books where the sound O might have only one or two spellings.
Right.
Even though O might have six or eight, possible spellings in English. So they limit that. Now here's the interesting part. What happens when you say to Johnny, Johnny, we lied to you. There really aren't two spellings for O. There's another one. And you add that. Now Johnny has to reorganize his whole schema to include that new spelling. Then he's, at the point he's starting to feel good about that third spelling of the O sound, you introduce a fourth. And it turns out that's terribly expensive. It's costly. It causes confusion and unnecessary drag. It's an unnecessary cognitive load, as we would say in social science research. So what I say is, no, we can't limit kids. First of all, I'm using tongue twisters, which means you can't write a sensical tongue twister without the full lexicon of English at your disposal. Right? You can't write Penelope, pit stops, pink parasol, perforated, profusely, pending Paulina's prenuptial agreement or whatever. So you cannot write a tongue twister without pulling words from everywhere. Well, that includes all spellings. Does that make sense? So kids read literally every possible spelling combination when they see a tongue twister. Well, how do we overcome that? How do I not overwhelm the child? Well, I'll tell you. I put the Pope's phonetic alphabet above. So now we'll go back to the computer. The letter A is ah. The letter O is aw. So every time that sound appears in a word, the phonetic spelling appears above. So they have dictionary spellings below. So they see the spelling patterns, but they have a reading reflex, meaning they can't make a mistake because they know the letter O is always the aw sound. So they literally cannot mispronounce ever. Now, here's the miracle of that. The miracle is that initially I thought, well, how am I going to pull these training wheels off? These kids are going to be confused. They're going to think this is two spellings. It turns out that it doesn't bother them at all. They know the top thing is just a picture of a sound. It doesn't bother them at all. And the bottom is the real dictionary spelling. And so those training wheels come off very quickly. They only use that for a short time. Then you pull them off. Wow. And because they're exposed to all possible English spellings, when they finally see a word in a book without training wheels, they automatically parse it into the sound. So they're able to decide that cough is a two-sound word, right? Though is a two-sound word and cough is a three-sound word. So they're able to do this when they've been taught to read with the cheat above, with the phonetic spellings above. So that's the miracle of it. And that was the hypothesis that I had to test. And it turns out the training wheels are the key to everything because it unlocks the full spectrum of English spelling variations without adding any additional burden to the child. Because they literally, oh, that's Billy, that's Susie. They know the names of 40 kids. Well, now they know the names of 40 sounds.
Right.
It's never hesitation. They can see the sounds. they can glue them together and they can speak just like a computer would decode text and read to a blind person. It's literally the same program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing with us, Timothy. This hour has gone by super fast, but you've had so much good information to share. And I do encourage our listeners to check out Timothy's website. It's spellcode.info. And he'll have some information there. He also shared some links with me of some of the things he talked about. And I'll put those in the YouTube description. So you can click on those links and there'll be a link to his website there, too. And thank you for partnering with us at Sped Homeschool too, Timothy. And he's on our reading page. So if you're looking for just reading curriculum, you can find Spell Code there as well. Thank you for taking time and sharing with us and just your passion for helping kids be more literate. I mean, all of us, really.
Yeah, appreciate it. I enjoy it very much.
Yeah. And this broadcast was sponsored by viewers like you. If you want to make a tax-deductible donation to Sped Homeschool, we are our 501c3 nonprofit. You can just visit our website at spedhomeschool.com, and we appreciate that. That's what keeps us going. Next week, actually, we're not doing a broadcast, but we are doing one Thursday night to make up for that. And so Thursday evening at 6:30 Central, we are going to be talking about everyday activities again, but this time on how to determine therapy goals for your child as we wrap up this month of kind of easier way to do things and diving into some ways that you can teach on the go. And that's kind of what our goal is for next month as we focus on that. But so I hope you can join me for that special time on Thursday night. And we'll just keep the empowering conversation going. So thanks again, Timothy. And thank you all of you for joining us again on Empowering Homeschool Conversations. This has been a blast. And we'll see you next time. Bye, everybody.